This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for limited time and subject to change, max one offer per account.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here and back with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we are very excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's start with probably the biggest news in the U.S. press this past week, which was the passing of Pope Francis. So what happened? Did a pope die?
A pope did die. Pope Francis has been unwell for quite some time, as I'm sure people are aware. He died on Monday. He had recovered. He'd been in the hospital with double pneumonia, very serious. There was some concern when he was in the hospital that he was never going to get out of it. But he did. He did recover enough to resume some of his duties. But he died on Monday after suffering, according to Vatican officials, a stroke and cardiac arrest. He was 88 years old. As I said, he'd been unwell for quite some time. This was not terribly surprising, although it was somewhat sudden. Given that he had recovered from his previous illness, among his final acts was a meeting apparently with the primordial ooze that calls itself J.D. Vance. And I'm very sorry to him that that had to be one of his last acts on Earth. I have to say that is not the way I would want to go out.
How does it feel like knowing you were maybe one of the last officials to meet with him before he died?
Yeah, you know, I thought a lot about that. I mean, it's pretty crazy, actually. And obviously, when I saw him, I didn't know that he had less than 24 hours still on this Earth. I think it was a great blessing. But, you know, I think he saw a lot of people. I think he affected a lot of lives. And I try to just, you know, remember that I was lucky that I got to shake his hand and tell him that I pray for him every day, because I did and I do.
But yeah, I don't want to dwell too much on this. I mean, the Pope is a head of state, and it feels like something we should talk about. He does have moral influence over at least European politics, if not, you know, Western politics generally. There was an outpouring of sentiment for Pope Francis, who, of course, was known to be relatively progressive by the standards of the Catholic Church, certainly by the standards of his predecessor, Pope Benedict. Anybody would seem more progressive than that guy. He wasn't a former
Hitler Youth member.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the bar is set kind of low here, but he was certainly more progressive than Benedict. And I think generally for the church as a whole was fairly progressive. His body's lying in state at this point. They're still, I think, ironing out the final details of his funeral. And then the next move will be, of course, to hold a papal conclave for the cardinal electors to choose a new pope. Francis has chosen was able to select, I think, something around 80%, somewhere around 80% of the current body of cardinal electors. So you would think
he
that
flooded
would favor
the zone,
somebody.
Dude.
Yeah, exactly.
He
kind of rigged the succession. You would think that would favor somebody who at least takes after him and to some degree in terms of his views on moral issues and whatnot. That said, I mean, I've seen speculation that there are that there's a lot of desire within the church to kind of heal whatever rifts form between conservatives and more progressive members during Francis's papacy. So somebody who maybe holds some of the same views, but is a little more moderate about it, or, you know, packages it in a little more moderate way could be favored here. I don't know. There doesn't seem to be a clear sense of a successor right now. I've seen, you know, lists of like 10, 15 cardinals who could wind up succeeding him, and nobody seems to have a great sense of who it might be.
Yeah, and of course, the big question going forward with the Catholic Church in general is, are they going to choose someone from the areas of the world in which Catholicism is growing, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, or another pope from the Western Hemisphere? Of course, Francis being the first pope from the Western Hemisphere. And I don't know, Derek, I don't know if you know, but the Catholics have been in the Western Hemisphere for quite a while at this point.
It's taken them a while. Maybe they'll pick another
years.
Italian. I mean, God knows it's been a while since they picked an Italian. And that's
medieval Italian popes were fun. But that's I think to me one of the in addition to obviously the ideological contours, whatever pope is elected by the conclave, what region of the world that pope will be coming from. And you know, Derek, I'm not sure if you're aware, but Catholics and Jews, we've had our ups and downs over the course of the last couple millennia. One thing that always struck me as interesting was a lot of the Nazi hierarchy was Catholic, which was unique within Germany. And Bavaria in particular was a Catholic heart of Germany. And a lot of the Nazi elite, obviously, including Hitler, right, were Catholic and or came from Bavaria. So an interesting wrinkle in that. But, you know, Francis, he had his issues, but he was the pope that I think I could get behind in terms of the popes in my lifetime. He called, I believe, a Gazan church every day. Right, which is doing commendable stuff.
He called every night.
Ratzinger would have never done. Yeah,
and did it all the way to the. No, Ratzinger would have been, you know, signing bombs probably.
Never did that. But you know, he will be missed as far as popes go. Whenever I think of the Pope, I always think of that early conspiracy about Pope John Paul I. And sort of the heart medicine was, we should do something on that. That's a wild story. If you haven't heard,
that would be a good one. Yeah,
if you haven't read
the Vatican Bank, all the scandal around that. Yeah, or just watch The Godfather Part 3. Even though that's not a good movie,
but no, it's a terrible.
Even
movie.
So, it does get into that conspiracy.
Yeah, look up the death. I mean, it's all, that one approaches JFK conspiracy. Like, there's a lot of smoke around that conclave.
Yeah,
you know, that one's a really weird one. People look into the death of Pope John Paul I. All right, Derek, let's move on to quite an uplifting story. No, folks, I'm just kidding. And that is, of course, what's happened in India this week, where it's the deadliest attack on civilians in Kashmir in years. So, Derek, what happened?
Yeah, I think you can go all the way back. I don't have a comprehensive list of attacks in Kashmir over the years, but I think you can. It's possible you could go all the way back to 2003. I think to find an attack that was this deadly, targeting civilians. Like the focus for Kashmiri militants in recent years has really moved toward striking at security forces almost exclusively. But on Tuesday, gunmen, the details are still kind of being investigated, but India authorities now say it was three gunmen attacked a group of tourists, I believe, in the Kashmir region near a resort town called Pahalgam. They killed at least 26 people. Dozens more were wounded, some of them seriously. So it's possible that toll could still rise, although it's been a few days now. I think it's been stable at 26. There has been, an outpouring of rage from Indian officials internationally. A lot of outcry over the civilian death toll, as I say, which is quite high even by the standards of this conflict. A group called the Resistance Front claimed responsibility for the attack. The Resistance Front emerged in 2019. It's related to the much better known group Lashkar-e-Taiba. It's either a splinter group or an offshoot from Lashkar-e-Taiba, or as the Indian government seems to think, it's more of a front group, like a cutout for Lashkar-e-Taiba. What's relevant here in terms of what else, the other things we're going to be talking about, is Lashkar-e-Taiba has probably, although the Pakistani government denies this, has almost certainly received considerable support from the Inter-Services Intelligence Organization, Pakistan's spy organization. And, you know, that support has probably been downplayed in recent years or diminished in recent years. But there was a time when Lashkar-e-Taiba got, I think, substantial resources, or at least the Indian government accused Pakistan of providing substantial support for Lashkar-e-Taiba. And so this takes on the character of an international incident rather than just a simple act of terrorism. The Indian government has, in addition to pursuing these three gunmen that it says carried out the attack, has also taken a number of measures against Pakistan. It closed, I believe, the main checkpoint along the Indian-Pakistani border, Atari Wagah. It has banned Pakistani nationals from traveling to India. It's withdrawing diplomatic personnel from Pakistan. It's also suspended a water treaty, the Indus Waters Treaty, I should say, which governs the shared use of the Indus River network. That treaty was negotiated back in 1960 to end, a lot of hostility or tension over the shared use of these rivers. The Indus River runs through Pakistan, but there are major tributaries that run through India, and so Pakistan's sort of downstream of those things, and they bicker from time to time about India, putting dams on those rivers, or claims that India is hoarding water and denying it to the downstream Pakistanis who need it. And so there's been a good deal of tension, even with the treaty in place. There's been a fair amount of tension over the years about the use of these things, but suspending the treaty as India has done, which is not something, as far as I know, that is legally allowed under the terms of the treaty, but India's done it anyway. The Pakistani officials have referred to this as an act of war, certainly an act of water warfare, which is something that we talk about occasionally on this show, that I think you're going to see more of from moving forward as climate change exacerbates water shortages. And this is the kind of thing that could turn very serious very quickly, because it's existential for Pakistani farmers, for Pakistanis who want to get a drink of water, for Pakistan, transporting goods up and down the Indus River. All of these things, very vital, could be affected by this. The Pakistani government has retaliated in a number of ways to these actions by the Indians. They're threatening to suspend basically all of their bilateral agreements with India, not just the Indus Waters Treaty, but all of them. They are, I think, mirroring some of the actions that the Indians have taken in terms of banning Indian nationals from entering Pakistan. They're not going to give out any more visas to Indian nationals. Pulling their diplomats out of India. So the two sides are definitely escalating things very quickly right now in response to this attack that happened on Tuesday. And as flashpoints go, Kashmir, India, and Pakistan is one of the biggest potential flashpoints in the world. And, obviously you've got two nuclear armed, not particularly friendly countries staring at each other. So incidents like this have to be taken, I think, very, very seriously.
Yeah, and this is the region where I think almost all modeling for nuclear war usually begins with the war between India and Pakistan. The last time I looked up to this, which was admittedly looked this up, was admittedly a few years ago. And from what I recall, the exchange of about 100 Hiroshima-level atomic weapons, which obviously are like very low yield compared to thermonuclear weapons that came after, right, would result in a global famine. So this is why I think that this kind of stuff needs to be taken really seriously. And it also highlights the importance of like U.S. aiding Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. It's like very dangerous, actually, nuclear weapons. And Kashmir was always the metaphor or analogy that I chose when trying to understand the dangers of Ukraine, or at least to think about it before one jumped in head first. We'll pay close attention to this one.
I think it's always been considered the likeliest scenario for a limited nuclear war, a quote-unquote limited war to break out. And, this is a region that, from the standpoint of water, is one of the most important in the world. There was just a story earlier this week prior to the Pahalgam. It might have been last week, actually, but about the water situation in the Hindu Kush Himalaya region, and it's getting increasingly dire. Like, seasonal snowfall is down, glaciers are retreating, and you're talking about billions of people who ultimately rely on this region in some way to kind of provide water to their major tributaries or major river systems, extending in an area all the way from like Pakistan, India, even Afghanistan, all the way, you know, across southern Asia and into southern China. Any conflict that happens here, especially if it involves nuclear armaments, is going to be incredibly devastating.
Thank you, Derek. Let's move on to talk about Yemen, where everything just seems to be escalating these days. It's been the deadliest U.S. strikes to date there. So what happened?
It was late last week, sort of Thursday, Friday were the main strikes. And then Saturday, there was some additional attacks. The U.S. bombed primarily the port city in northern Yemen, the main port city, Hodeidah. The deadliest, as you said, attacks on U.S. attacks on Yemen to date. They killed, I believe, over 80 people was the figure I last saw. I don't know if that's risen at all, but they killed, dozens of people, let's say. There were reports of heavy damage to the Ras Isa seaport, which is one of the main facilities at Hodeidah. Most of northern Yemen's humanitarian aid flows through that seaport. It's also got a fuel storage unit. There's been concern. I'm not sure if it's been the damage has been assessed fully yet. There's major concern that damage to its fuel storage units could cause fuel leaks into the Red Sea. It could cause fuel shortages across northern Yemen, which would then exacerbate any effect on humanitarian aid flows, because of course you need fuel for the trucks to take the humanitarian aid from the port across, to communities that need it across northern Yemen. Major escalation, I think, on the part of the Trump administration, the effect of which I don't see much of, as has been the case with this entire operation. The U.S. Pounds northern Yemen. It kills a bunch of Yemeni civilians, mostly. The Houthis just keep on doing what they're doing. Earlier this week, they fired a missile at Haifa, which certainly is something I think this attack on this war on Yemen, the renewed war, is supposed to deter. They fired a missile on Haifa that very nearly, I think, got to Haifa. The Houthis have attacked Haifa in northern Israel previously, but never got anywhere close to it. This time, it seems that their missile did get into the general vicinity of Haifa before the Israeli military says it probably was intercepted. They couldn't be definitive about that. The upshot is, the Houthis seem to be proceeding without much effect, despite all of the carnage that the U.S. is causing here. They also shot down, apparently, another Reaper drone. They've done this several times. They claimed late Tuesday to have shot down another one. The U.S. military has acknowledged that it crashed. They haven't acknowledged a shoot down, but that certainly seems to coincide. Each one of these Reapers, and there's been some reporting about this, like each one of these Reapers costs about $30 million. The Houthis are shooting them down with weapons that cost, let's say, substantially less. And there's an economic aspect of this, or a financial aspect to this, where the U.S. is pouring millions of dollars into just bombing Yemen for reasons that don't really seem to make a lot of sense, because they're not having much impact. They're spending a vast, much more money trying to deter unsuccessfully the Houthis than the Houthis are spending to carry out their operations. So it's all kind of silly.
Derek, let's stay in the region and tell us developments on Gaza. If people haven't listened yet, listen to our Tuesday episode where we talked about that in more depth, or really Derek did.
Yeah, I talked to Mohammed Al-Safin on Tuesday, and there's really not much else to say that we didn't talk about in that interview. The Israeli campaign has continued. They're still swallowing up more territory. They're still carrying out regular airstrikes every day, still blockading aid from coming in. All of these things we talked about on Tuesday. There is a bit of news out of the ceasefire negotiations. The Qatari and Egyptian delegations mediating ceasefire talks basically went for broke. It sounds like they put a proposal on the table for a 5 to 7 year ceasefire under which Hamas would release all of its remaining captives. There would be a corresponding exchange with Palestinians under Israeli custody. They would give up administrative control over Gaza, which is something that the Hamas has already, you know, said it would be willing to do. And they would also lay down arms. There's some ambiguity about whether this means giving up their weapons, which has been a demand of the Israelis for disarmament, or simply, you know, take some steps to ensure that they would not resume violence against Israel. I'm not sure what those might be, but something short of outright disarmament, which which Hamas has said it would not do. They've characterized that as a red line. So there's a lot of details here that still aren't clear, and I have to imagine this isn't going to go anywhere because the Israelis don't want this. The Israeli government doesn't want an extended ceasefire. What they want at this point is to shove the entire population of Gaza into a small area, either the Mawasi area, the so-called humanitarian safe zone along the coast, or now I've seen speculation that they're trying to shove the population of Gaza into the Rafah area, which has been cut off from the rest of Gaza by a new Israeli security corridor. Either way, it's about cramming people into a small, tightly packed area. The ostensible result of this would be a resumption of humanitarian aid. This is according to the Israelis when they try to justify what they're doing, that if they get everybody, all the civilians into Rafah, they could resume humanitarian aid under some, you know, arrangement with private companies, or, you know, I'm not sure what the mechanism would be. The rest of Gaza would be turned into effectively a free fire zone. Anybody who's there would be considered ipso facto Hamas or some sort of militant and be treated as such. And by cramming people into a very small area, you make it very easy to do what the Israelis really want to do here, which is to enact the Trump plan to get all the Palestinians ethnically cleansed out of Gaza and turn it into a, you know, U.S. resort colony or whatever the hell is in the offing there. So, you know, I think things are still proceeding in that direction. I wouldn't expect much to come of this Egyptian and Qatari offer, which is or proposal. It just doesn't tick off any boxes, I think, for the Israelis.
Okay, let's talk about Iran and the progress made on U.S. nuclear talks with the country.
This is somewhat remarkable. There have been two successful, apparently, meetings now between U.S. And Iranian negotiators. Not between, that's probably misleading. They haven't been direct talks. They've been indirect negotiations. There was a first round in Oman on April 12th. There was a second round in Italy on April 19th. In both cases, the Omani diplomats mediated between the two sides and kind of shuttled between them to enable indirect negotiations. There was, and Donald Trump had claimed prior to the April 12th meeting that there was going to be actually direct talks between the U.S. and Iran, which is something the Iranians have refused to do without some, you know, preliminary indirect discussion. And they kind of squared that circle by having, I think, Steve Witkoff and Abbas Araghchi, the Trump envoy and the Iranian foreign minister, like shake hands and say a few words to each other at the end of that first session. But otherwise, these have been indirect talks. There's no indication that they've made much tangible headway, but they have been apparently successful enough that they agreed to meet again in Oman this coming Saturday, the 26th. There will be technical negotiations, which is interesting because that's where a lot of the real movement can happen here, and technical experts, you know, talking about how you could implement a limit or limitations on Iran's nuclear program, which is what these talks are about. So there will be technical negotiations that take place on Saturday as well. Those were originally supposed to take place, I think, prior to Saturday's diplomatic discussions. But the Omanis, for some reason, or at least that this is the story the Iranians gave, the Omanians asked to hold those off until Saturday as well. So there is the potential for some movement here. And Donald Trump has said he doesn't want this to turn military, although he is committed to taking military action to prevent Iran from, or to destroy Iran's nuclear, whatever he thinks he's going to do. It's far-fetched, but he has threatened military action, but has said that's not the direction he wants this to go. He wants a negotiated settlement, probably along the lines of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which of course Trump famously balled up and tossed in the trash in 2018 during his first term as president. But that seems to be where things are right now. Now, the Trump administration is insisting on an end to Iran's uranium enrichment program as one of its key points in this negotiation. And I think that's where, if anything, kind of queers the deal, so to speak, or prevents a deal from coming to fruition, this will be it. The Iranians insisted back in 2015, and one of the reasons that negotiation went was successful is because Barack Obama eventually gave in to this demand that the Iranians had to have their own uranium enrichment, domestic uranium enrichment capacity. The U.S. concern has always been that for Iran to be able to enrich its own uranium is a vector for the Iranians to develop nuclear weapons if they so choose. Iran's contention has been, in the U.S., the U.S. offer, counteroffer is always you can just import reactor fuel, low-enriched uranium, from, the global market. There's not exactly a shortage of reactor fuel on the market. There's no real reason why you should want to have a domestic enrichment capability. You can just buy, what you need internationally and fuel your reactors. The Iranians can point to a number of instances that actually have taken place since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, where the U.S. has stepped in to interfere with Iran's ability to buy reactor fuel on the international market and prevented it. And that's the Iranian justification for wanting to have an enrichment capability. And, again, if the Trump administration is going to take this position, this kind of maximalist position that Iran can't have any enrichment capability, I don't think this is going to get very far in terms of approaching a deal. Well, what the 2015 deal did was say Iran could have an enrichment capability, but it had to be under strict international supervision. And the Iranians were okay with that. They agreed to that. But then, of course, as I said, Donald Trump chucked that deal in the trash, and we're at this point now where military options are on the table if a deal can't be reached, and the Trump administration is not showing much flexibility on this point.
Speaking about making great deals, let's talk about the U.S. tariffs on China, and they might be lowered.
Deals are Donald Trump's life, or I forget what he said this week. It was like, deals are my thing, whatever. Amid all of the tariffs, there's tariffs one day, there's no tariffs the next day. One day there's, everybody's got 50% tariffs. The next day they got 10% tariffs. It's been a mess to try and track this stuff. And then you've got exceptions for, some car makers don't have to pay tariffs. And now we don't have tariffs on smartphones. But who knows? Stay tuned, because those could be coming later. And it's been a lot of, we don't really know what we're doing, basically, from the Trump administration. And this policy is changing day to day. But as it stands right now, after all of the tariffs and all the rounds and the, reciprocal tariff thing, which was then reduced to 10% for most countries, tariffs on most Chinese products, U.S. tariffs on most Chinese products at this point, again, with the exception of electronics like smartphones, computers, that sort of thing, stand at about 145%, which is ridiculous. It is an effective ban on Chinese goods coming to the U.S., at least unless you want to pay a great premium to do it. The Chinese government has retaliated with 125% tariffs on U.S. products. And given how much economic activity goes on between these two countries, this is just an unsustainable state of affairs. Like, you either have to fully decouple, which would be hugely disruptive, or somebody's got to give here. There's got to be some movement away from where things are right now. And the intention on the part of the Trump administration has been, the stated intention has been, well, we're going to do a deal. We're going to negotiate with China. We're going to get a deal that'll lower all these tariffs, and everything will be fine. But there's no negotiations happening, and there's no prospect of negotiations happening. The Chinese government has repeatedly said it will not negotiate as long as these kind of punitive unilateral U.S. tariffs are in place. And so things are at a stalemate. The Trump administration this week has been hinting to several media outlets, and Trump himself has publicly suggested that he might be open to reducing U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods to somewhere between 50 and 65%, quite a come down from the 145% they are now. But there's no plan in place. There's no firm proposal for how you would do this. And there's a lot of details to be worked out. Certain categories could be, subject to higher tariffs than other, sectors. There's a lot of moving parts here that I don't think have been worked out yet. Nevertheless, just the hint of a reduction in those tariffs caused, the stock markets to bounce up again. And, this whole new round of speculation that Donald Trump is just manipulating the stock market at this point, but we won't get into that, I guess.
I would not my president, Derek. Let's move on to Sudan and talk about the RSF closing in on Al-Fashir.
The RSF, which has been besieging Al-Fashir for months now, as people know, was able to seize control last week of the Zamzam Displaced Persons Camp, which is one of a number of camps that have sprung up around Al-Fashir, mostly housing people displaced from other parts of Darfur. Al-Fashir is the capital of North Darfur State. It's the last city in Darfur that is not under RSF control. Zamzam was the largest of these camps that have sprung up housing people displaced from other parts of Darfur by the RSF. Some 400,000 people, it's believed, were displaced again by that attack on Zamzam, or by the seizure of Zamzam. The RSF has killed dozens, scores of people really in and around Al-Fashir over the last couple of weeks. 400 was the figure I saw just last week, and then they continued their attacks throughout this week. There was they killed at least 30 people just on Sunday, and so things have been pretty intense. The RSF, having been booted out of most of all, I think perhaps at this point, of the capital region, Khartoum, Omdurman, etc., really seems to be turning its focus on Al-Fashir and trying to consolidate, take that city and consolidate its stronger position in Darfur. Where that will lead is still unclear. The Sudanese military does not, from what I can tell, appear to have shifted resources to Darfur, at least not yet, to try and take on the RSF there. What you could see if the militants are able to take Al-Fashir, which seems like eventually, this will probably be the case. You could see a de facto partition of the country. The RSF is strong in Darfur. It's got a strong position in the Kordofan region, not quite as strong as its position in Darfur, but still fairly substantial. And you could see a sort of RSF-controlled statelet emerging in those areas with the rest of the country, nominally at least under military control. But that's divining the future. I don't like to go too far in that direction. I just would say, I don't think there's been any move by the military to try and bolster its position in Darfur, and Al-Fashir really seems to be on the brink at this point.
Ugh. Spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Let's talk about these peace talks in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Yeah, there's some question as to what's going on here. What we know is that the M23 militant group and the Congolese government had been meeting they had delegations in Qatar, in Doha. They've had them there since earlier this month, a couple of weeks at this point. And on Wednesday, they left, the delegations left Qatar. There was a report by Reuters citing sources from both camps, make of that what you will, that said that the talks had broken down and that they'd broken down primarily over technical issues and sort of confidence building measures was the term they used. Chiefly, M23 was demanding the release of hundreds of prisoners being held by the Congolese government for suspected involvement with M23 or with Rwanda, the international backer of M23. The Congolese government doesn't see much distinction between M23 and Rwanda. So they were demanding the release of hundreds of prisoners, and the Congolese government basically said, no, we're not going to do that. And it was on that point that the talks broke down. Now, that said, despite this Reuters report, the Congolese and M23 delegations or officials announced when they left Qatar that they had agreed to a ceasefire in their conflict, which is mostly focused on the provinces of North and South Kivu in the eastern DRC, that they had agreed to a ceasefire and that they are going to continue to work toward a peace deal. So, that doesn't necessarily rule out that the talks really legitimately broke down. And they're doing this as a sort of face-saving measure to obfuscate what's really happening. But it does suggest that the Reuters report, I mean, it does open the possibility that the Reuters report was wrong, incorrect, mistaken in some way, and that things actually are progressing. There are always points in these negotiations where the two sides have to sort of, go back to their respective corners and regroup and discuss where things are headed before they go back to the table. So that could be what's going on. It's just impossible to know at this point. And as I say, this just happened within the last day or so. So we'll have to wait and see how things play out.
And we will wait. And Derek, we will see. Let's move on to Russia and talk about the Kursk operation, which is coming to its end.
It really does seem so. Valery Gerasimov, the commander of the Russian military, told Vladimir Putin on Saturday during one of these staged ritual televised cabinet sessions that Putin likes to hold, where all of his officials tell him what a great job he's doing, told Putin that Russian forces have taken back or now have control of, he said, 99.5% of Kursk Oblast, which, of course, the Ukrainians at one point controlled a substantial portion of. I don't know if 99.5% is exactly accurate, but the Ukrainians are down to one village along the border that they seem to be holding on to mainly to try and blunt any Russian invasion of neighboring Sumy Oblast, which is across the border in Ukraine. It does seem like this is mostly at an end. I would say, mission not accomplished. I mean, I'm still not sure what the mission was, frankly, for the Ukrainians to do this. So I really don't know what to say about it other than that, if they were hoping to hold territory in Kursk and bring that to the table in any sort of peace negotiation, they are clearly not going to be able to do that.
Well, let's now talk about these potential negotiations. First, Derek, tell us about Putin offering to halt the Russian advance at the current front line.
Yeah, Putin, this was in the Financial Times on Tuesday, reported that Putin, in one of his chat sessions with Steve Witkoff, we mentioned him earlier, the Trump administration envoy / de facto Secretary of State, that Putin had told Witkoff that he's prepared to halt operations at the current front line in Ukraine. This is an interesting development, if it came about as a result or as part of a peace deal. It would represent something of a concession on the part of the Russians. The Russians, of course, occupy portions of five. They have a tiny portion of Kharkiv Oblast, but they would give that up entirely, I think, under the proposal that's on the table. But really four provinces in Ukraine. They control significant portions of Donetsk, Kherson, Luhansk, and Zaporizhia. But they claim control over the entirety of those provinces. The Russian Duma has passed, measures annexing the entirety of those provinces to Russian control. Nobody recognizes this, of course, except the Russians. But the claim is on all of their territory. What Putin seems to be offering here is to say, we're going to give up our claims over the portions of those provinces that we don't already control. We will maintain our presence or our occupation and control of the areas that we do have, but we can freeze things at this point. So this is meaningful. Luhansk is mostly, all but basically controlled by the Russians. There's a little tiny portion of it that's still under Ukrainian control. But Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, there are substantial areas that are still under Ukrainian control. Kherson is sort of a different story. The Russians would have to cross the Dnipro River to try and retake the parts of the province that they previously held and lost. I don't see them being able to mount that kind of operation. But Donetsk and Zaporizhia, they've been on the offensive and on the move for months now. So to freeze things would be definitely a concession, I think, in those provinces to the Ukrainians. That's an offer that's on the table as part of the bigger picture peace negotiations, which, I know you want to get to, where the Trump administration is putting, on the table this proposal. But we can talk about that next.
Yeah. So what is this proposal? What does everyone seem to think of it, basically?
Yeah. So, I mean, the proposal, pieces of this have come out and detail. There are a lot of open details and major things that it's unclear how they would be managed. But the contours that have been made public of the proposal that the Trump administration has put on the table, the U.S. would recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea in a formal way. It would recognize, legally that Crimea is now part of Russia. That would be the main U.S. offer to the Russians. It would informally accept Russian control over these areas, as I said, on the mainland that Russia occupies without, I think, formal legal sanction. It would be a de facto partition of these areas. The U.S. would also work to lift Western sanctions on Russia. There's only so much the U.S. could do here because some of them are, of course, European Union sanctions or U.K. sanctions. The U.S. doesn't, necessarily control those processes, although it certainly has some influence. This is met, though, a major pushback from the Ukrainian government, from Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, who would not apparently be obliged under this deal to actually recognize Russian control over any Ukrainian territory, but would be effectively, if he agreed to something like this, be giving up his, the dream that he's always articulated to the Ukrainian people, that we can kick Russia out of the entirety of our pre-2014 territory. We can take everything back, including Crimea. And he said publicly in response to this proposal that's on the table that he can't countenance any admission of Russian control over Ukrainian territory. Well, of course, this has led to another outburst from Donald Trump, who took to social media on Wednesday, called Zelensky's position inflammatory, very harmful to the peace negotiations. He said that Zelensky can have peace or he can fight for another 3 years before losing the whole country. That's a quote from his little Truth Social network.
He says, and it's not even a point of discussion. Nobody is asking Zelensky to recognize Crimea as Russian territory, but if he wants Crimea, why didn't they fight for it 11 years ago when it was handed over to Russia without a shot being fired? The area also houses for many years before the Obama handover major Russian submarine bases. It's inflammatory statements like Zelensky's that makes it so difficult to settle this war.
So there's a lot of discord now in the U.S.-Ukrainian relationship. Zelensky also is demanding, or he's insisting on, a 30-day temporary ceasefire as a prelude to further discussions about peace deals. I think is sort of a test of Putin's seriousness here. And Trump, in contrast, seems to want to jump right away into the peace deal without, bothering with any sort of preliminary ceasefire. As I say, there's also a lot of open questions here about what Ukraine would get in terms of security guarantees. The proposal that the Trump administration has made does outline at least in vague terms, some sort of European security guarantee that the Ukrainians could rely on to prevent a resumption of war on Russia's part. But of course, Russia is still, the Russian government still, you know, has, is, you know, taking a flat line rejection, you know, and making, you know, flatly rejecting any talk of European soldiers or European military forces being stationed in Ukraine. So it's unclear how that that circle would be squared. Now, I should add to this, there's been a lot of discussion or a fair amount of number of comments coming from Trump administration officials, Marco Rubio, Trump himself, J.D. Vance, most recently, suggesting that this is a take it or leave it offer, that the Trump administration, if Russia and Ukraine don't agree to this proposal that he's put on the table, that they put on the table, they're prepared to just walk away from this whole thing, which would not just mean walking away from the peace talks. It would mean, you know, no more aid for Ukraine. It would mean, you know, a lot of cutting off Kyiv from military or financial support. So it would be a full, I think, break with for the U.S. from this conflict. I should also add that the Russians, I guess, to try and make their point stronger, killed, I think, 9 people in Kyiv on Thursday, you know, in one of the deadliest, if not the deadliest, Russian attack on the Ukrainian capital in several weeks. You can contrast Trump's kind of harsh rhetoric towards Zelensky with what he posted in the wake of that attack, where basically he went on his little media, social media app and said he is not happy with the Russian strikes on Kyiv, not necessary and very bad timing. Vladimir, stop. So, yeah, a little less kind of a little more plaintive, a little less hostile, I guess, when he's talking to Putin.
Yeah, definitely. And you know what that means, of course. Who knows what Putin has on him? Are we going to finally see the P-tape, Eric?
Is real. I mean, that's a real thing. Foundational principles of this show is that the P-tape is real.
I was listening to someone talk about that the other day, and they still
really?
people are still saying it's real. Jesus Christ. Okay. All right, let's move on to the greatest country on earth, and that is, of course, the United States of America. And let's start with this reorganization plan for the State Department that Secretary of State Marco Rubio has released.
Rubio put out a new organizational chart and proposal earlier this week to reorganize the State Department. It is, you know, in keeping with the work that the lovely Doge Department with, you know, good friend Elon Musk, you know, has been doing to other parts of the government. But it does not go as far as I suspect Doge would have gone if it had been allowed to run hog wild in the State Department. It also does not go as far as had been rumored for, you know, about a week or maybe more than a week beforehand in various reporting about draft documents that were circulating or, you know, executive orders that were being prepared, that sort of thing. What the reorg that Rubio put out, the plan that he released, basically does what you would expect. It closes down any bureaus in the State Department that don't fit, that are woke, like they don't fit the Trump agenda. Anything having to do with human rights or democracy or women's rights, minority rights, diversity, anything like that. I haven't seen all the details. I'm sure anything having to do with climate would be in there. Like, just anything that's too woke for the Trump administration is being closed down. They're consolidating the number of offices, about 137, I think, was the figure I saw, offices within the State Department would either be merged into other offices or phased out entirely. But as I say, this is not as drastic a reorganization as had been speculated prior to that. There had been talk of like the State Department basically just shutting down its entire African bureau, eliminating embassies across Africa, like, you know, keeping maybe a few in countries that are deemed particularly strategically valuable, but just like demolishing that bureau almost entirely, like having the department's budget, taking a chainsaw to a lot of things. That does not seem to be what's on the table here. And you know, there's some speculation, maybe, you know, Marco Rubio was able to win some sort of diplomatic, bureaucratic infight with the, you know, the other people in the Trump administration to maintain a larger State Department than otherwise the administration would have wanted. But I don't know.
Yeah, and the State Department, of course, always particularly weakly funded compared to what we're going to talk about now, which is the Department of Defense, where Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is not doing as well, Derek, as you or I might have.
Well, you talk about funding. I mean, they're proposing a $1 trillion Pentagon budget. I think $300 billion of that is going to go into maintaining Pete Hegseth's signal channels, where he blurts out the details of every operation the U.S. military is going to undertake. No, this is incredibly Hegseth. The New York Times reported over the weekend that, you know, I'm sure people remember the insipid SignalGate scandal, where they had a group chat on Signal within the Trump administration, and included Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic magazine for reasons passing understanding, and just talked about, you know, all the details of their plan to resume the eternal war on Yemen. Well, apparently he had a second Signal chat that included his wife and his brother, his personal lawyer. Both his brother and his lawyer have jobs in the Pentagon for some reason. Who knows? But anyway, though, they were all included in this second Signal chat, where he did the same thing. He blurted out the operational details, at least according to the Times, of the planned bombing campaign against the Houthis. Hegseth has called this fake news. But, you know, I mean, he did it once. Why not twice? Why not? Why not? It seems very believable, let's say, at this point, that Hegseth would have done this. This comes in the context of just like the Department of Defense is apparently leaking like a sieve. At least three senior figures within the kind of upper echelons of the secretary's office or around the secretary's office, which means they were all either appointed by Hegseth himself or by people Hegseth appointed, have been suspended in recent weeks, for recent days, for participating in some, you know, multiple leaks apparently coming out of the department. There's been an investigation into it. They have all written, they wrote a, I think, joint nasty letter about, you know, how they've been singled out by Hegseth and the department for failures that go well beyond them. But basically, it seems like a mess inside the Pentagon, which is probably not that different from how it usually is inside the Pentagon. When you're given vast amounts of money, you can, and no oversight, you can't even pass an audit, you tend to things tend to go a little loose. But you know, it's public, it's messy. Hegseth was a controversial pick to begin with. You may recall, Danny, he had to agree to give up drinking to have the job.
I thought that was not a fair requirement, personally.
Yeah, I think, you know, he should be three sheets to the wind all day long, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, this is sort of all piling up at this point, and there's been scuttlebutt that the Trump administration is vetting other potential Secretary of Defense candidates. It would be interesting if Hegseth was the first guy out the door. You know, there was famously a lot of churn in Trump's first term. I'm not sure he lost any cabinet secretaries this early on, though. So it would be a sign that we're moving on to bigger and better things, I guess, to get a cabinet secretary out this early in the second term, excelsior, as they say.
I say bring back Rex Tillerson, move him from State to Defense, and just let the man cook.
Where is he? I haven't heard. An ex-Secretary of State, he just disappeared.
He hasn't answered my chats in months.
Might as well be at like Antarctica at a research, you know, post or something. Like, he's just totally disappeared from public life. It's wild.
I have no idea what he's up to. But anyway, thank you everyone for listening. We usually don't do this, but if you can, please consider liking and reviewing the podcast. Only good reviews, of course. We don't need any of those bad reviews. We don't need any of that negative energy in our lives. But it actually does help the podcast. It brings it up on people's feeds. We want as many people as possible listening to us as Trump 2 winds on. Derek, thank you as always. Thank you everyone for listening, and keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.